Hi, I'm Matthew Newhall. Welcome to the first episode of the Technocrat Live. There was a problem with the audio in the beginning of the video. I'm sorry, it won't happen again. My guest is Isaac Falcon. We began by discussing his role as a pen tester. Please enjoy.
Web app stuff, because again, there are better people for that and so forth. So
did you ever?
I'm old school niche.
Do you ever accidentally light a data center on fire or? You know, push a server out the window thinking that the rack went further back or anything like that?
No. Well, I mean, I've been in a data center where somebody knocked over rack, like a row of racks of machines.
Really?
Yeah, that was fun. That was the late 90s.
Did they use a forklift or were they just hulking?
Well,
server, make me angry.
So way back in the day, Sun made these 4U tall servers that were, you know, full depth, yay big, and they would just be loaded full of disks and so forth. I actually have one.
Really?
Yeah, it's called a thumper. It's got like 44 disks in there.
Is it souvenir or you just can't move it from wherever it
fell? It has 44 like hard drives you can put in there.
Nice.
1 terabyte each, you know, that's a lot of disk.
They're up to 14.
44.
Yeah, no, I was saying that.
Oh, 14 terabytes per day.
Yeah. It's crazy, man.
It's nuts. But anyway, this guy was servicing a much earlier sort of notion of that back in the 90s. So, you know, like pocket smartphone, but an entire rack of them in terms of processing capacity.
Right.
And the guy was just putting it in RAM. And so he took one of them out and rolled it out on the slides, and turned around and tried to get a thing. And he wasn't really paying attention. He'd unscrewed all of them. So what happened was when the rack started to lean a little bit.
Oh, it did the toolbox thing.
Thunk,
where they show the baby being crushed by the toolbox.
And so each machine in succession slid itself out, which completely changed the center of mass. And it pulled that rack. It was bolted to the other racks next to it. And so you just heard this horrible screeching noise.
How many racks was it?
It was the entire row.
Right. So like it, 10, 20, 30?
No, it was like 8.
Still, that's
probably
impressive.
It might have been 10.
Oh, my
but,
God.
Yeah, I mean, the ones on the end
that's
were
a million
still,
hits on YouTube right there.
The ones on the end were still upright, but like it made this weird bow as all these machines just kind of fell. They finally propped up on the bottom server, and the guy is just like sitting there. They're standing there and trying to avoid being pinned.
Yeah, at least he didn't try to catch it. I know a guy who got hurt working in a shop, and like something fell. And I'd do it too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so crazy.
It's an instinct.
Right? You're just like, oh, this thing's falling. Let me stop it from breaking.
Be protected.
And guess what breaks? You.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You figure you're invincible, not the, you know, $1,000 piece of equipment or whatever. But yeah, that was entertaining. I just kind of wander out. I was like, you okay? All my gear is two racks.
Well,
two
if you still hear
almost.
Screams, there's hope. When they go quiet,
that's when you have a problem.
That's when you got to worry, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was a fun time. I had a pen test for an insurance company though once that they wanted me to. It was a light manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a laser cutter for, it went up to about a quarter inch aluminum.
Right.
And the insurance company was like.
So wait, hold on a sec. So they had lasers? Lasers?
Lasers.
Excellent.
A laser CNC machine. And they're like, do you think you could get the thing to fire, you know, out of sequence or whatever? Because, you know, it's like, well, UL tested this thing. It's like, yeah, but they tested the parts of it. It's
not
like they tested the software or anything. So I got to play with a laser cutter for a while, and that was cool.
That's great.
Yeah. I got to cover my name out in a CNC machine. I lost it somewhere along
the great thing about lasers is they just keep going.
Yeah, as long as they got power.
But right.
That was a fun one.
It's probably not good to be a laser scientist in a city.
No. Yeah. Although you do get the cool glasses.
Yeah. The steampunk pull-down, flip-down ones.
Yeah, or just like weird colors.
Right. I've been trying to find a good pair of those for my bike so I could ride around looking like half scientist, half crazed biker. Anyway.
The internet.
I haven't found it. You know, it seems like it would be like a natural fit for steam. I want them to actually work, you know, to be actually ANSI.
Oh, not just like glued gears.
Yeah. And I don't want it to just be cosplay. I want it to be real glasses.
No.
Okay. Yeah. There's probably going to be like a million links. Like, duh, they're right here. Anyway.
It's a good support mechanism you got.
Yeah, so, you know, actually I have a good story about a data center. So actually my last gig, it was 2 days before Hurricane Sandy, and I had just looked at the weather, and I was like, this is bad. This is really bad. And at that place, they had a data center close to the water. And I went to my boss's boss, and I said, this is going to be a really bad hurricane. There's going to be a storm surge. And we really need to start. Now, it's a secondary data center. We really need to clear out this data center and get these servers out of there.
Yep.
And they were like, yes, don't worry about it. It's just a secondary data center. Needless to say, 2 days later, after I walked the bridge to get into the city, they were now pulling the servers out of the data center that had water up to the removable panels on the floor.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Oh, good.
I was right. I called it, man. I mean, you know, so what do you do in that situation when you're in, like, you know, you're working, doing pen testing, someone's hired you to find a potential flaw, but it sounds like Chicken Little, and they're like, I can't believe you, this is going to really be a problem for us.
It depends on the gig, it depends on the customer. A lot of times, if it's the sort of person who really wants to know if there are issues, they're going to take what you have to report very seriously. And there's a level of trust. Like, there are a lot of companies that'll go out there and they'll give you, like, the output of some automated scanner that'll tell you, you know, like, oh, you're using SSL or TLS V1, and TLS V1.2 is, like, the new standard, or, like, oh, your RSA keys are only 2048-bit when they really should be 4096, and that's the Chicken Little bullshit.
Right, right.
And it's just, no, guys, don't waste my time with that stuff. I try not to do that. Like, I will tell you, yeah, there's a bunch of little piddly crap that you could clean up in the course of a weekend if you really wanted, but here's what you really need to focus on, you know, architectural issues.
So it sounds like you're not, like, worried about liability at all. Like I assume, did they sign a waiver?
Liability?
Do they sign a waiver?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's just the goodness of your heart that makes you trying to make it
better. Oh, try not to really break things while I'm
No. I mean, like, you know, like, when you're like, this is going to happen, and they don't listen. How do you just, I guess, all right.
Oh, that happens. Yeah. You know, you deliver the report, and then it's like, do you want me to help you to remediate this? And if not, then you don't.
Right.
I actually had a customer that... I had previously done a fairly large, a gross sort of analysis of their network, and they had a DNS vulnerability, an internal DNS vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Their DNS servers were susceptible to cache poisoning.
Right.
And, you know, it's internal DNS, it's a big corporation.
Mm-hmm.
10,000 seats, lots of servers, like that.
Why don't you give cache poisoning 30 seconds in case someone doesn't understand it, because it's going to be a mixed audience.
Yeah,
you know?
That's fine. So how DNS works.
Right.
What is DNS, the domain name system? You type in www.google.com, and your computer doesn't talk English or letters. What it does is it talks numbers, IP addresses.
Right.
And so what it does is it goes out to the internet. Imagine a cloud here with lots of cats videos. it asks, hey, I want to go to this string. What is the address, the numeric address of that? We'll say it's .1.2.3.4.
Right.
The server that goes out and does that is called a DNS server, and that network of servers is the domain name system.
Right.
And your ISP's DNS server, or your DNS server that you run, or your company's DNS server, will get the result, and it tucks it away in a little pocket. Because you're probably not the only person who's ever going to go look for www.google.com. There's probably a lot of people who would like to go to www.google.com, and Google servers aren't going to change very often.
Right.
So you put it in a cache.
Right.
So that the next time somebody asks, you don't have to go all the way out to the cat video land. You can just, like, have the result right there. It's a little sketchbook that you have. Cache poisoning is telling the DNS server a result that it didn't ask for, so it puts it in its little crib sheet without having gone out there. So instead of being...
Awesome explanation. Keep going.
So instead of that number being 1.2.3.4,
right,
you make it 5.6.7.8. So anybody that uses that DNS server is going to get the wrong address.
Right.
Or the poisoned address. So anyway, this company had DNS servers internally that were susceptible to cache poisoning. And, you know, I put it in my report, and it was fine. And about 4 or 5 weeks later, I get a call in the middle of the night because I had a good rapport with them. And I'm like, listen, we've got a problem. And we think it's name server related. Do you think it might be this poisoning thing you were talking about?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what? It's 2 a.m.? Like,
I guess they didn't have voiceover.
My contract... Yeah.
Like, good thing, right?
Like, this contract was paid and, like, a month old now.
The power of procrastination.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
And so, it's like, can you help us walk through? And I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. And so I go in there. Like, they sent a cab to go and get me and bring me back to the facility. And I get in there, and the longer version of the story is short. What happened was they had acquired a new company, and this was the first night that the two networks were together. And they had two computers that had the same name. And so this part of the company wanted to connect to this computer, but they were instead connecting to the other one. And then this part of the company was trying to connect to the wrong computer. And so it was all screwed up. And
so it wasn't a split brain.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
It was a namespace collision. So it wasn't a problem with the cache poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
But when I turn and I go, so you guys didn't fix that, right? They're like, no. I'm like, hang on, I can fix this.
I remember, okay.
And intentionally deployed the correct information poisoning all of the caches.
So your delivery method.
My delivery method was
cache
was
poisoning.
Yes.
That they didn't bother to fix.
Exactly.
Procrastination!
I took advantage of the flaw to actually deliver the correct information more quickly than doing it the right way.
Right.
And then I'm like, one of them said, "Is like, well, I'm sure I'm glad we didn't fix that, huh?"
Yeah.
And I just want to smack him upside the head. It's like, I shouldn't be able to do this.
I'm clever and brilliant. Yeah. No, you're a pointy-haired boss. I'm
yeah.
Sorry.
So that was an entertaining.
Maybe somewhere in between. Maybe there. Well, you know, there's got to be something to the pointy-haired boss who keeps winning, right? You know, they keep winning. You know, shooting from the hip sometimes does work.
Well, the thing with the Peter Principle is right up until that last promotion, you're doing really well.
Right. Yeah. 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 I love Lawrence Peter. Great. So, by the way, if you want to like promote your company or how people can contact you, or they'll find
it's
you.
It's all word of mouth.
Right.
My busy season starts soon. It's the spring, so all the golf courses open. And then everybody talks about stuff on the golf course. And I'll get
nice.
My call. It's weird. It took me years to realize that. Because
really?
I used to try to go away for the summer. And then my winters would be dead.
Yeah.
Like my busy season wound up being the spring and the summer, and I didn't realize why. It's when all the inquiries came in, and I finally figured it out. It's like they're just talking about, like, oh, yeah, I got this guy who helped us out with this thing on the golf course.
Right.
Because they're executives, and that's how they talk about stuff.
Right.
So. I'm a very bad golfer, too.
Right. So my son plays golf. He's pretty good.
Nice.
And I'm excited for him for being able to use it for corporate espionage purposes. or at least being able to climb up the corporate ladder until he's reached his level of incompetence.
Because, right.
You know.
There you go.
Yeah. he might be watching right now. So
notes.
He's a big gamer. Mm-hmm. So I haven't really got him into the... He's got the knack, but he's just not... He's not like into it yet. It's really weird. Like I thought, like we went and we did a show for Lilug where we were showing off Raspberry Pis. It was for Slime, the Slime conference.
Okay.
And Slime's like this Nassau County thing where they're trying to get people interested in STEM. That's a whole other rant about how.
When did we come up with all of these acronyms?
You know, I the STEM stuff is kind of crazy because I think that I feel like they're sacrificing kids in school for the sake of all the kids out there everywhere not getting, you know, four square meals of education.
Mm-hmm.
So they're throwing everyone under the bus just trying to find five more computer science students. I think that's almost how I see the core curriculum, and STEM is like the PR branch of that. And I'm not saying that people shouldn't go into science, and it's awesome, and I want that to happen, but I'm bummed out because I feel like not everybody can be a computer geek.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone can't be, they can't do it.
There's a, so throwing money behind a particular set of classes and courses and so forth. That's the STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, mm-hmm. and math. There's a competitive advantage.
Yeah.
In terms of the world market, because as we're getting more and more globalized, particularly in terms of things that are easy to do remotely, programming and computer science and engineering and so forth, we need to remain competitive. But it's really gotten to a point in the world where being a part of any field, you're going to benefit knowing how to program. How to really use a computer, even if you're not into an engineering discipline, even if you're not going into technology, being able to program a computer greatly improves your life. I have friends who get a lot of email, and they use Gmail, and you show them how to use filters and labels and tags and things like that. And just within the concept of Gmail and how to filter and shuffle around your messages is very powerful for them.
Right.
But is also very difficult because they haven't quite learned how to think like a machine.
Right.
Procedurally and think process-wise
and think
in algorithms.
Yeah, people can't do that, man.
Yeah, but that's where I think all of the STEM stuff is getting, putting the cart ahead of the horse.
Right.
If we had a much better sort of education around just learning how to think algorithmically, learning how to think procedurally, learning how to think mechanically so that we can interface with these machines better, you'd be in a better place. And then you can start doing the STEM stuff
and
get rich.
I'm totally not against that. Everybody wants that,
yeah.
Right? But I just don't know if it's realistic. I mean, I've just, having sat with, you know me, I've worked in a lot of scientific institutions with top scientists. Usually, the bulk of it was genetics, but not all of it was.
Yeah.
And some was physicists, and they just it's not an intelligence thing. These people have IQs that these people have phenomenal IQs, and they're battle tested. You know, they've discovered something new, and they just don't get it. I could sit there and explain it till I'm blue in the face. Is it an age thing? I mean, I guess that's what the thinking behind core and STEM is, but I don't know if I buy it
it's a way of thinking,
right?
And I think that's where our educational system.
That's the knack, right?
Yeah. Well, just to step away again, what the educational system should be doing is teaching you how to think, not necessarily what to think,
right?
Or these are the subjects you should be interested in. This is the process by which you can arrive at truth. This is the process by which you can solve problems. This is the process by which you can conduct research and draw conclusions and so forth. And there's
right.
no course for that, right? There's no specific class that teaches you how to do research. There's no specific class that teaches you how to arrange data,
right.
or not necessarily even go into a statistical analysis or anything, but just how do you collect data? What are data? What
right.
is it that you can do with this? What is good data? What's bad data? How do you throw stuff away? I mean, unless you're in hard math.
Well, some of that is learned. Yeah, some of that's learned.
But even just procedurally, I have a zip car to come out here today.
Right.
I live in the city.
Right. Did you pay
drive
for
very
it?
Much? Yes, I paid for the zip
car. I'm sorry, I had to rib you.
There's. Yeah, it's
summon car.
We're going to get to that point.
Yeah, yeah.
But their system in terms of how the cards work and the prox cards. It's interesting. And it's a good time.
Come back to that.
Yeah, we'll come back. The subway. The
zip car.
Metro card.
Evil. Okay, zip car evil. Go on.
Yeah, zip car evil. Little note. I was driving out, and it was a Subaru that had. Lane detection and staying in your lane, little nudges on the steering wheel, and then obstacle avoidance and collision prevention for lane following. So I had the cruise control on, and it's got this little control for how close do you want to get to the car in front of you. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? And it would get to a certain point, and then it would start to slow down, and eventually it would brake. And I'm thinking ooh, how does this work?
Right.
That's interesting. And I start thinking about, it's probably some sort of radar system or LIDAR system or some kind of thing that there is a sensor in the front of the vehicle that is measuring perhaps grossly, perhaps finely, the distance between me and the things in front of the vehicle.
Right.
Well, how is this going to behave if somebody comes into my lane?
Right.
And those are the kinds of thoughts that I certainly have, because I have a sort of engineering mindset and I like to think about how things work.
Right.
But if you're...
You know what it means? It means you're really boring.
It means I'm a horribly boring
you're
person.
You're bored. You're terrible parties. Nobody wants to talk to
but
you.
But the consequence of something like that is if you don't understand how the system works,
yeah.
you can be surprised by it.
Right.
So when somebody comes into the lane about halfway and then sort of like makes their way back out, what's the car going to do?
Right.
If you don't expect that, oh, okay, well, one of the sensors says one thing, the other sensor says the other thing, what's the conflict? You know, what's, you know, coming from that engineering mindset,
mm-hmm.
you're less likely to be surprised. You
right.
can accommodate that. You're accommodating the machine. If you don't know how it works, you're going to be like, oh, crap, you know, why did this thing just suddenly slam on the brakes?
Right, right. You're going to overreact. You're basically going to have two chefs yeah. making the stew, and it's going to be terrible.
What was your first experience with anti-lock brakes?
Anti-lock brakes. So I hated them for years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So,
I mean, like the very first time you were in a vehicle with anti-lock brakes and you hit that pedal.
Oh, of course.
And it goes.
I pumped the brakes. Right.
Right. And
yeah,
you're like,
I see your point.
Whoa, what just happened?
Yeah.
If you're, I don't want to tout myself as a great engineering mindset, but I recognize how I think.
Right.
You know, the first time I encountered any lock brakes.
Well, hold on a second.
That's
well,
really weird.
Just want to pause.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Well,
and a lot of people don't do that. A lot of people
don't think
recognize
about how, I think. Yeah.
how they think. Continue.
Yeah. So. The very first time I encountered any lock brakes, it's like, holy crap, what just happened? Oh, it's just pumping the brakes really fast. That makes sense. You know, what are the traction implications and so forth? Yeah, you know, you can get too far in your head and not think about that. But the next time I was, A, less surprised, B, understood how it worked,
mm-hmm.
And how it's not exactly perfect.
Right, right.
There are conditions where pumping your brakes really fast
I had
is not that great an idea.
I had an interesting story about that, too, where I was first car with anti-lock brakes, first time they came into action, I went into action at the same time
mm-hmm.
because I was an experienced enough driver at that point that I knew, okay, slippery, I got to pump the brakes.
Yep.
So they're going, and I'm going,
and you're fighting it.
And I'm fighting it, and it actually made it less effective, and I made the car a little bit harder than a normal car with me pumping the brakes would have been to control.
Yep.
So it almost got me in a wreck.
Yep.
Right? Yeah.
Exactly.
Which is exactly your point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, if just having that sort of mentality for understanding the things that you use in your daily life, you can really leverage and get power out of them as opposed to being sort of manipulated
See,
by
now
them
I've
and
got
controlled
you.
By them.
Now I've got you. Now I can ask you the hard question.
Ooh.
So where does it come from?
Where does what come from?
That thought process. The engineering thought process.
The sort of engineering thought process. I think it starts with curiosity.
Yeah.
I think it starts with a methodical approach to discovering your environment.
Right.
It's not natural to everybody, I don't think.
Right. See, this is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So this is what's the problem with that STEM, that I don't want to pick on STEM. STEM's
yeah.
fine. STEM's just a PR strategy.
Mm-hmm.
The real problem is the Common Core strategy of, you know, because I see my kids coming home. My kids succeed because they both have the knack,
mm-hmm.
you know, in this environment. But I see other kids struggling. They just don't,
yeah.
they're having trouble wrapping their, I see what they're doing. They're trying to make you look at every problem six different ways.
Yeah.
Right? So instead of just, you know, remember that funny line that was actually in the ad, so you might have seen it from The Incredibles, where Mr. Incredible's like, math is math, math is math. Right? They're breaking that, and they're trying to get you
yeah.
to look at it from a bunch of different ways. But, and for someone who has that engineering mindset, it, on the assumption that you're born with it, you know, you approach it that way, and you go, okay, I see what they're doing. I understand the concept better than I ever did because
yeah.
they presented it to me this way. But for every kid that's like that, there's another kid that's like, there's too much information,
yeah.
I can't handle it, and their
yeah.
brain melts.
I think it can be learned.
Okay, interesting.
I think it can be learned.
Well, I don't know, but I'm not sure I agree.
I don't know either, in all honesty. I'm not a cognitive scientist or a psychologist.
Anyone knows.
I doubt anyone knows anything.
It's like we're deploying the IT strategy in the
yeah.
education system, like, you know, fire ready aim.
Yeah.
You know?
So we've got a there's an interesting sort of like maybe case study in terms of new math. Were you around for new math?
I was, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was
sequential?
Well, So I was probably one of the last new math course teaching students before they reverted to like normal math.
Right.
And a new math.
Okay, so maybe I don't know.
Yeah,
what you're talking
about. My first grade education in mathematics was sets.
Okay.
And basically number theory. We didn't assume base 10.
And the rest is history. Good night, folks.
Yeah.
No, just kidding.
We didn't assume base 10. So they taught you addition, or just number representation, right? Like you had objects.
Right.
And they came in groups of things. So if you had 1, 2, 3, 4 objects, and you had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 objects, and you added them, you would represent that as, say, a seven, and then you have an eighth, and in base 8,
right,
you would take 8 of those and you would say 1 in the eighths place, and then there's 9, so there would also be a 1 in the ones place, so the number is 11,
right,
in base 8,
right. But it's not 11.
Which no one uses. But here you are, a first grader, learning at that deep level.
Am I going to out you if I ask you what year that was?
The early 1980s.
Close. That's awesome. You knew immediately to go vague on that.
Yes, it was early
1980s. So PCs were out.
Yeah, that
you were like, you grew up with PCs like me then. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I my first computer was a Commodore VIC-20.
Perfect. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So you did that in first grade, and then you went home and looked at your computer, and it went and rainbows sprung from its monitor.
Yeah, that came a little later.
Okay.
But new math was, I mean, it showed up in the 60s. It was like fairly everywhere in the 70s, and towards the late 70s and the early 80s, it was starting to peter off.
Right.
But the thing with new math was, why don't we teach these students like the basic philosophical basis of mathematics?
Right.
Addition is you have these things and you put them together and then you re-represent that number and whatever else. What that allowed me and a lot of my peers to do, I get hex.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, you get it. You grok it.
Like it is deep-seated in me because of those very early
If you
years.
Don't know the word grok, learn it. Yes, you grok it, yes.
Yeah. Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Excellent book.
Yes.
Definitely worth reading. A lot of Heinlein, frankly. But
Heinlein!
Yeah. Like, base 16 is fairly natural to me because base 10, it was never surprising. And I think that new math was one of those overreaches.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, to your point, you know, maybe not everybody gets it. New math was everywhere. Like, it became the core curriculum during the 70s.
Right.
And they reverted because it was confusing people. It was confusing the adults and their parents. Like, imagine going home, you know, these poor parents.
Right.
It's like, well...
Well, at least there was one parent home at that point.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, now they're both at work and they come home like, yeah. Really?
Like, adding in
just,
base...
Just fail, it's easier.
What the heck? Yeah, what the heck is base 8? You
know? Yeah.
If you want a really fun thing, Tom Lear is a pianist, and he used to write these fun
pianist.
Songs. He used to write these very clever songs back in the 60s, and one of them was called New Math.
Right.
And look for one on YouTube where they actually try to sketch it out on the chalkboard, where you do a simple problem in New Math, and you'll learn everything you need to know about that. Anyway, by the time I got to about second or third grade, we'd reverted to the other math. So it was like, oh yeah, multiplication tables. What base are we in? Okay, so I have to compute.
So what you're telling me...
8 times 7, so I had 8 groups of... No, just memorize the answer.
You literally had a human type error is what you're having.
Basically, yeah.
Oh. I'm having a type error. I don't know what to... This student is very strange. I don't know what they're talking about.
But the basic point is that, like, I'm not sure that it's completely an innate thing, or if it can be learned, or if there's some combination thereof. What I do know is that we're not teaching that stuff anymore. We're not teaching how to think as a real direct sort of goal within education.
Right.
And that probably should change.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so... the focus in schools, how do we get into schools? This is really strange. Anyway, it just kind of flowed there.
We were talking about slime.
Talking about slime, I brought it up. I brought up my kids. And yeah. All right, so schools, you know.
Hi, kids.
Yeah. Get a Raspberry Pi. It's $39. It's worth it.
Yeah. I just got mine recently.
So I just bought another one. I'll forget that other point. This is more interesting. So I just got another one, and I realized something. I can just do total data center deployments from a Raspberry Pi. So, I just never registered before. I thought about doing it from a laptop, from a VM on a laptop, or a special boot on a laptop, or, you know, sticking a server in a rack. It's like, it's really terrifying how much control you can have with a machine you can barely physically see.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Have you ever done that? For hijinks, of course.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, there's lots of fun that can be had.
Yeah, there was a good Mr. Robot on that where they stuck it inside of a thermostat. They stuck a controller inside of a thermostat to take over their fictional version of Iron Mountain. I hope I don't get sued for that, but you know, that's what it was, obviously Iron Mountain, you know, in the show.
The very first, so I haven't actually seen Mr. Robot.
Sorry for spoiling it.
Yeah. I've seen I think one or two episodes of Mr. Robot. I saw the premiere, the very first episode.
Mm-hmm.
And my servers are in it.
Really?
They apparently filmed the data center scene at NYI, where I colo my stuff. And I'm like, that looks really familiar.
Holy crap, that is like some Matrix synchronicity shit going on right there.
It's pretty funny.
That is really weird.
And then I'm told that the premiere episode of the second season, they're in the bar that I hang out with at across the street from the Hotel Pennsylvania where they have Hope.
Wow, that's crazy. So,
and I know the guy who does the tech consulting for them, so I don't know if he's screwing with me. I should probably see the show.
Right.
Apparently,
right.
The guy who was in it was in that Queen movie where he played Freddie Mercury.
Really? Oh, is that him? Is the same actor? Mm-hmm. I don't know his name.
Alec something or other.
Yeah, he's really good.
A cool name.
Yeah, he shows a lot of depth. Have you watched Mr. Robot? You said this the first two episodes.
I've seen like one episode.
Hey, it's a really interesting concept of an Uber hacker with mental illness, and you put those two together, and you know where does it go? What
Isn't
can go wrong? Yeah, well,
with movie drills.
Pi was awesome. So go see Pi, and you know.
So get a Raspberry Pi and see Pi.
Get Raspberry Pi and see Pi. So
well, there should be Pi here.
You know, it's kind of like an art film, so I guess I don't even have to worry about spoiling it.
Mm-hmm.
It's so brilliant. I mean, it's so obviously like they even made the guy look like Linus Torvald. You know, it feels authentic. You know,
in Pi,
yeah. The actor looks a little bit like Linus Torvald. I thought, yeah, I don't know, maybe it was just me, but yeah. I mean, where if you figure out an identity, you get a divide by zero error, right?
Mm-hmm.
You figure out some formula, and then all of a sudden the system literally just breaks,
yep.
And you're like, I'm doing something wrong, and it's so. And it was almost comical because like a you know someone with the knack would kind of figure that out and go,
me,
yeah, I'm crashing this every time. I must have something going on here. I have to figure out how to turn this formula around the other way, right? But still, epic movie, very realistic. So
it's worth
the hour and a half.
I'm trying to remember it, frankly. After I watched, I had to get it out of my head.
This is, like, I have a list of notes here that I can just go to. This is great.
B flat, F sharp.
Oh, yeah. bass. So, not the treble clef.
No.
So, I guess the reason, probably the point, one of the points I wanted to come back to, was something you were talking about, was this learn to code. Thing that's going around. So there's this thing where the press was bugging people, like basically whenever anyone got laid off, there would be either the I don't want to blame the press because it's not really their fault. It really came from the politicians. And I think for the politicians, it came from a misconception.
Mm-hmm.
And the misconception is, regardless of whether it's genetic or not, it ain't easy to get into the engineering mindset.
Nope.
No, you got to work at it. You got to be at it for years. And they're basically telling the coal miners, well, just learn to code.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, you're working in a physical, you're used to the physical space,
yep.
Right? I mean, it's like the thinking in numbers and thinking in logic and thinking in language is very, very different. Doing both of them and enjoying both of them.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is and it isn't. Like, there are a lot of really bad programmers out there.
Yeah.
Because they don't think.
You just have to get it right once, right?
they don't think like a machine.
Right.
They don't prepare their the biggest problem that programmers have is that they don't design.
Right.
And I'm saying that as a security guy. I'm saying that as an administrator. I'm saying that as an engineer. We've developed this culture of coding where you just start typing crap. Mm-hmm. Just start typing. You know, the compiler will yell at you. It's like nobody designs anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the entire ecosystem is built around not designing, not structuring, not architecting, not even having an idea of what it is that you're trying to build. Like, could you imagine an artist doing that? You know, you got a sculptor, he's got a big lump of marble.
You know what it screams of? It screams of learning your craft on the job.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's a big problem, to say the least. And that's why you have these...
Well, what should we do about it? I mean...
Again, teach people how to think. Teach people how to approach problems in a methodical way that you can have measured success. It's hard. It's so easy to like import, you know, GPS reader, and not have to think about like data structures or anything like that. Just you know, what's a program? It's just a bunch of subroutines calling other subroutines.
Yeah, and then they don't realize that they unintentionally introduced a backdoor
to say the very
which
least.
Someone comes along and exploits.
Right, and it, you know, it's,
and then you hear about
it's
you
like,
watch their stock plunge in the news, you
right.
know, and everyone's like, how'd that happen? And be like, and the press gets it wrong because they don't really get what happened.
Absolutely, I mean. You can have, here's we have a brick wall here. Like, you can have these well-designed pieces that are done by someone who's smart. Like, we always tell people, like, don't write your own crypto. It's hard.
Oh, my God.
You know, don't write your own crypto. It's super hard. And I agree with that.
I always thought of security as hard. So crypto's like the next order of magnitude harder. Because now it's security for money, or at least currency.
Or for anything. Yeah.
Right.
Crypto is hard because there's a lot of things you have to think about at the machine level, because you have to avoid side channel attacks and things like that. The math is hard. You do a lot of math in crypto and so forth. So the idea is, like, you know, leave it to somebody who knows what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
We have the OpenSSL issues, but we won't go down that road. But but you have these, like, oh, I've got a library, it's been written, it's been tested, it's all the rest of this. And so a lot of these line programmers figure they're just stacking bricks, and all they have to do is pour the mortar in between them, and it's like, oh, import this, and I'll use this library, and I'll call that, and I'll do the other thing, and this API, I'll interface with that other thing, and so forth. And, like, they don't even treat the mortar with anything.
Right.
They have no idea of how these bricks are supposed to stack up. It's
right.
like watching a 3-year-old trying to build something out of Lego, and, you know, they want the tower to be
you
super tall.
You pretty much just described, like, physically, you pretty much described New York City. If there was an ever earthquake here, having lived in an old brick building that was literally held together by two bolts. I know, it's just a metaphor, but
no,
it's still kind of an interesting one, because if it's just a thin stack of bricks, it only takes a little sideways, a little lateral motion,
even a little stress,
and
or you've got some kind of weird cantilevered thing going on, and
mm-hmm.
because you've never designed it, you don't understand how the weight is supposed to be distributed. We're still using metaphors as opposed to like actual programming.
Well, the great thing about metaphors is sometimes you can go right off the rails and into the soup, and then sometimes you figure out something new with it.
Yeah,
you know. So
I
love metaphors.
I hate them.
Really?
They're imprecise, and they tend to lead people in the wrong direction.
That's true.
You can get too hooked on them,
right?
Particularly when you're trying to explain something to somebody, and then they goes like, "Well, yeah, it's like playing the violin. Oh, so your neck has pain, and so that's like when your carpal tunnel syndrome." It's like, no, No, you're going too far.
Like, well, you know, neck pain
is not. You need an oil change. Like, just stop with the metaphor.
What are you doing to me?
Back to the problem at hand.
Right. Yeah. No. It's actually, I found a lot of people with very analytical minds are like that. They dislike metaphors and they dislike analogies and they dislike.
It's a great introduction, but you have to get rid of it as soon as possible. Like, once you get somebody up to speed or at least a little bit of traction, it's like, okay, let's put that aside and we'll talk about the real thing now.
Right.
Because you can get stuck in the metaphor and try to elaborate on the metaphor and you build the metaphor as opposed to actually building understanding.
See, so I completely understand where you're coming from, and definitely in the process of, in the strictest sense, in the engineering sense, you're really just running numbers and you're seeing how things are going to pan out and you're seeing what's possible, and or a statistical sense, you know, a mathematical sense.
Yeah.
But I would actually disagree with you on that.
Ooh.
Because I think. No, don't hurt me, please.
This is a block.
No! Okay. No, it's just, I think the way that the brain works, it actually metaphors. So, this is kind of crazy. This is off topic. I hope it's not too far down the rabbit hole. But,
your show, man.
Yeah. It is my show. So.
Cheers to that.
Hey, cheers. And thanks for being on it. I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
I can't believe you don't want to plug your stuff.
Wine in a martini glass.
I can't believe you don't want to plug your stuff. You don't want to say my company is... Da, 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 da.
I don't have stuff to plug.
You don't have to tell people who you really are. And, like, you know, you can just... Anyway. So,
yeah, Isaac@ctech.org. Like,
yeah. Right. Of course. Right.
Easy to find. Isaac@2600.com. That still works.
Right. Yeah. I'll come back to 2600. So, the way I think it works is, I think our brains. So, I think our conscience and our subconscious is the same thing. Imagination is within that space, and this isn't just willy nilly. I spent like a lot of time thinking about this and trying to figure it out. And I think that insight is really what drives most creative thinking, including analytical thinking. So what happens is you have an insight, and it's just this thing from the fog of your subconscious, and you can't see it directly. So then you have to rationalize it. So you go over, you gloss over it, and you look inside, and you say, okay, does this make sense with what I know about how the world works analytically? Mm-hmm. And either it doesn't make sense, insights are wrong sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens. I think people run with wrong insights, and that's what metaphors sometimes encourage people to do.
Yeah.
But if it turns out that it's true, you know, especially if you're young enough, this may not, I'm not sure if this is true when you're older, or at least it's harder to do when you're older, but you come up with this archetype where you have a new kind of structure for how this thing looks and what the attributes of this thing are. So, you know, if that happens, I think that metaphors and analogies are a way that adults in particular, but also kids. Maybe it's not as necessary for kids, but adults jumpstart themselves to create a new archetype.
Yes, and that's why they're powerful.
Hold on. Understand what I said?
We're on the same page.
Great. Okay.
Yeah, metaphors are very powerful.
Right.
And you know, it's like power. You know, absolute power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. You know, a powerful metaphor is useful.
I am metaphor man.
Yeah, but an you know. A very powerful metaphor can corrupt. Like, here's a great example. You've never seen a hippopotamus before.
Mm-hmm.
And I described to you, well, you know, a hippo's kind of like a pig and a horse together.
Right.
Right? And you're like, oh, I know what that is. It's sort of rounded, it's pink. Oh, and it's got tusks. Like an elephant? Yeah, sure, why not? What animal? Okay? And you kind of get an idea, you're like, sort of picturing a hippo in your head. Mm-hmm. What animal on Earth is the closest genetic relative to the hippopotamus?
I actually have no idea.
The whale.
Get out of here.
Yes.
So
hippopotami have more in common with whales than they do any other land animal.
Oh, interesting.
And so if you go down this metaphor of it's like, yeah, it's like a pig and a horse and an elephant had a weird fun Friday night and created this big pink monster.
Committee, yeah.
Right. And yet the actual biology is much more fascinating.
Right.
And if you stick with the metaphor of like, yeah, it's another land animal that just happens to be semi-aquatic in Africa, you're going to lose out on the richness of actually understanding the biology of the hippopotamus.
See. Okay. Now I see why we agree.
Yeah. So the metaphor is really useful for an introduction.
Right.
You've got to kind of like shelve it quickly.
I don't just think it's useful. I think it's what makes us human. But
yeah.
that's a bigger.
Oh,
really?
The world is super complex.
Yeah.
Brains are, we're thinking with meat.
Right.
Okay. We need every advantage we can get.
Sometimes if I think really hard, I hear squish. I'm going to get it for that one later, I'm sure.
Oh, sure.
All right, that's interesting. So I'm glad to hear you chime in on that, because I was I thought I was alone in that. I thought I was the only one, because there's so much focus on kind of this cold, dreary, analytical view of everything, and it makes me nervous, because sometimes I think we're not leaving room for creativity. And yes, the time to be creative is not when you're doing the final math on something that can kill people.
Yeah.
And unfortunately these days that's everything, because hear me out. Sure. So I'm segueing into something else we were talking about. So
do you remember when the Segway changed our world?
You're segueing my Segway. That's awesome. Literally segueing my Segway.
Yeah, I mean, the days before the Segway are lost to us. The transportation revolution. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that's great. That's all right. I welcome sci-fi future ruminations that don't exist yet. Really...
But I interrupted you.
No, this is our space, man. We need to be in... We need to do that. So, really, the thing that I'm thinking about here, so CPUs. So the problem is that we're not really building solid state devices anymore. And a lot of people, like, right, that sentence right there has not entered most people's brains. This is one of the reasons I wanted to do this show, because I'm talking to the geeks in Lilac. So I run a group, the Long Island Linux Users Group, and we meet every month and we talk Linux, and it's great. And these are the guys in the engineering mindset. But then I go and talk to someone else, and they just give me the slack jaw. You know, and part of it, and it's like 20 years ago, it was like we were fighting Microsoft and we were the scrappy rebels with hope, and now we're in charge. You know, we're completely in charge.
You really
of anything
think that?
Well, that everyone else thinks they're in charge. Okay. I'm actually not.
Oh, well, look. I've got a few complaints to bring to you. In
No, I didn't think of it that. I thought you just get grapes and
fans
and everything, and you're
and
a king. So the real problem is with solid state's going away, and everything has become computer controlled. I mean, we haven't quite got there, because some things have engineering requirements, so people will throw circuits on boards. But it's getting to the point where you can, you know, other than auxiliary boards, just to step up and step down electricity or change the electricity type, everything's computer controlled these days. So, I mean, and...
You just told everybody to go get a Raspberry Pi.
I did.
You're part of the problem.
I know. Well, soon enough, the robots are going to be the problem. So we're going to need to be able to fight back.
Well, that's a whole other ball.
And when we run out of spray paint, so we can spray paint over their sensors, then we're going to need to start learning how to actually hack them.
But you see, you have to understand how their sensors work, so you know how to defend yourself against the robots. It goes back to my prior thing about the car.
Right. So anyway, you know,
solid state. Yeah,
like we're getting away from that. And so the code that like wasn't that important before, and people would just, you know, just stack bricks and not think about what they're doing, we're still using it. We're still using methodology. We're still using the code. We're still using the same...
It's important to recognize that there, despite the fact that everybody seems to think that all the useful programming is on the web now...
Right.
Like, there
are... Well, APIs are awesome.
And it's just like the big cloud of cat videos.
Especially for you, but for everyone also.
Yeah, all the money's in Silicon Valley, and they're just coming up with new and interesting ways of making interfaces to SQL databases. And NoSQL databases, for that matter.
Right.
There are still people building real things in the real world, like actual engineers. Are you familiar with PLCs?
Please tell us about it.
All right.
Teach everyone about it.
Programmable logic controllers
right.
are the devices that basically run your world.
Right.
There's a fascinating...
For now. Yeah.
Well, so... If you understand how PLCs work...
Yeah, I know.
It's kind of amusing. Programmable logic controllers are sort of showed up in the 80s during the microprocessor revolution. Just like you said, everything's going to be a microprocessor in the whole nine yards. But what they actually do is simulate programmable logic, which was a series of switches, logical switches,
right.
in cascades,
right.
which is technology that dates back to like the 20s and 30s for doing signaling on railroads. What the PLCs in the 80s did was just simulate that.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same tech we're using today in 2019. So you have, like, it hasn't changed.
The brick wall.
Yeah. You know, your S7 controller is still basically a tiny little microprocessor, but when you program it, you're building these cascading logic gates as though it was a railroad yard in the 1930s,
right,
1920s.
Right. Well, all roads are the size of two horses' butts, so look that one up. It's good.
Yeah, the SRB is the width of
missiles
of Roman chariot.
Missile sizes based on Roman chariots, yes.
But if you don't know how to do that, there's no amount of JavaScript and Ruby on Rails and whatever the latest crazy ass, like, what is it, Haskell now, or everybody's talking about. All these crazy languages that keep reinventing the same thing over and over. Like, you don't use those to actually build the interfaces that go into our real world.
Right.
There are still very competent engineers who still have to do that. You know, embedded systems, we're starting to see more generic, like Python, the Raspberry Pi. You know, that's general I/O pins in the whole nine yards, and
right.
you're starting to get sensors, and you're starting to get, like, you know, motor control and things like that. But you're not going to run a nuclear power plant off of that.
Right.
You're not going to run a washing machine off of that.
So far.
You're not going to run a dishwasher off of that. You're not going to run a refrigerator
right.
off of that unless it's one of those super smart refrigerators which has a TV built into it.
So I agree and I don't.
Okay.
I want to say something about this and then I'll let you keep going off on it. Which is, and I hope you don't lose your point, but the...
I am so dull, I've never had a problem.
You're very sharp. So that's why, you know what, I couldn't interrupt someone else like I can interrupt you because I know you'll come right back to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that gives us a false sense of security because I wasn't pointing at the wine, but that's a great idea. So I think that gives us a false sense of security because there's the opportunity for chaos with lots of little things.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, it's good. Well, I'm so afraid of the toaster army, you know. But, I mean, if you haven't seen Fast and the Furious 7, go see Fast and the Furious 7. That's real.
Okay.
All right. No, you haven't seen it?
I have not seen a single Fast or Furious
I wish
movie.
I had a screen I could bring it up on right now because it's just one scene. It's spectacular. So there's this over-the-top hacker who's, by the way, stunningly beautiful. I'm not saying the hackers
Ooh.
Can't be stunningly beautiful.
Ooh.
But, you know, she's a little too made up to be, I don't know, let me see how I can put this. If you're about to launch a... anti-superpower attack against a country, maybe you don't want to spend an hour and a half on your makeup that day. Just that day. You can choose whatever path you want. We're politically correct, so I got to be careful here. You can choose whatever path you want, but I know it's a movie, but it was a little over the top.
It's how dressed up she was. Fast and Furious movie.
Thank you. You bailed me out. All right. Anyway, so
a little over the top is their bread and butter.
She's this crazy hacker, and she controls an army of vehicles. Sorry, I should just put a movie spoiler disclaimer on the website so people know. Just don't turn it on. If you want to watch any movies ever again and enjoy them. If you're interested in media. Pop culture is really powerful because everybody shares it, right? So I can use an analogy here.
Well, that's where your metaphors get crazy again because people seem to think the real world works like it does in movies. But
right.
Here
and it usually doesn't, but this time it was right.
Okay.
The only thing they did wrong is that they had the Crown Vic and the army of... of cars, which does not have a CAN bus.
It's not going to have a CAN, no.
Right, but all the other cars, they were right. They have CAN buses, and it is totally realistic for someone to control an army. She took over Manhattan, isolated a Soviet limo, and controlled the nuclear football, and stole it. And this could happen. And people going back to the point that I was originally saying, is like, you know, people are worried about the the nuclear failure, the nuclear plant failure because of a poorly designed code, you know, top down code instead of bottom up code. Mm-hmm. But like, I mean, what does it matter if you could just get the nukes themselves by isolating a city?
I can tell you what the nuclear launch code is.
Go on.
The PAL. It's 00000.
Right.
I think it's 7 zeros, actually.
Okay. Is that what they...
That's the thing you need to put into the weapon in order to arm it.
Well, it's been nice, folks. It was a good show. Yeah, SWAT will be here any minute.
It's 00000000.
All right, so are we talking 1950s here, or are we talking the current crop of ICBMs?
As far as I'm aware, they hadn't changed it.
Right, excellent.
But they put in the PALs in, I believe, the 60s, mm-hmm. and it was required.
Right.
And because they want to be able to, you know, use the weapons in an emergency,
right.
they set the code to something that everybody can remember.
Get them. I just watched Doctor Strangelove,
so
this is like right up.
Seriously, look this up. Like that is the code.
Right, right.
That is not the authentication mechanism where like
right,
the president, you know, they
okay,
crack
okay.
open the and all the rest of it. Mm. But if like you're
the two keys with the secret code,
you know, all the rest.
You
got
to tune to the right channel and yeah.
Right, you know, it's like the authentication system is still, you know, a one-time pad and all that. Regardless, but like if you're actually standing at a weapon and you're the guy who's supposed to deploy it and arm it, like mm-hmm. do, 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 you type in the thing and then the like logic within the weapon,
well,
the code
makes
for
sense.
It is all zeros.
If you want to have a human firewall, you know, his hands are going to be shaking, he's going to be sweating, he's going to go crazy, he's thinking about his dog and his cat and his family,
yep.
and he's
going
to, and his brain is just going to go blank because that's what our brains do and we feel that.
Anyway, hop onto FAS.org,
yeah.
Federation of American Scientists, and you can look into all this stuff.
Hop onto FAS.org.
Yes.
Play along then.
and that way
there's a crowd and they don't catch you because everyone's doing it at the same time.
We have a sophisticated system to prevent accidental or intentional without authorization arming of nuclear weapons, and the code is all zeros.
Right.
Because you want to be able to arm them.
So I have something.
Which is where negative and positive control, like you talk, I could go on for hours about negative and positive.
You know, I have something good on this too. I sat with someone who was working on improving the networking for the net that's used for the weapons.
Oh, that's a terrible idea.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't easy, and he explained why. But you know what? I'm going to skip that one. We're going to go into the next thing.
Yeah, good call.
Because I want to put it all in one show.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
The big nuke show, right?
It's going to become the nuke show.
That sounds like fun.
We nuked ourselves in the first episode.
Yeah. That was actually one of my minor...
No metaphor.
Yeah. Yeah, when I was on Off the Hook, we were talking about nuclear reactors and emergency procedures, and I had actually said, because I was moving so fast and I was so excited, I said, scramble the reactor, as opposed to scram the reactor. I apparently didn't even recognize it, and somebody called in within like 5 minutes, just, the term is scram. I'm like, I know. It's like, you said scramble like an egg. Like,
yeah, I you know what, that's why I welcome comments, and I'll probably read them until we actually get popular, right? But after, right? Because
yeah.
I just like, you know, I don't want to like let the entire troll kingdom
yeah.
storm the gates
we
and completely distract us.
We make errors from time to time.
Yeah, yeah.
Even unintentional, like I know the right term. Do you know it's an acronym?
What?
Scram?
Scram? No.
I forget the entire acronym, but the AM is Axeman.
Why?
So the very first piles, the
Axeman. It sounds like a heavy metal song.
So the very first reactor piles, the control rods were hoisted by ropes. And so if there was an emergency, you had to cut the ropes.
Mm-hmm.
And so the scram procedure was literally, there was an axe, and you would hack at the ropes to cut them so that the rods would fall.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
So hopefully they had the sense. So is this an old reactor. Is this the type 1 ones, like the GE kind of style plants?
Oh, pressurized water? No, this is like way, way back, like 1940s, 50s. They're trying to experiment with. They're using frickin' ropes.
Right, yeah. Oh, okay, so this is like the Marie Curie days where they like didn't even know it was killing them.
Like Chicago Pile stuff, sort of.
Yeah, okay.
Like that level.
All right.
Very early days, you know, like hand-built or hand-carved graphite.
What's this growth on my arm? That's so strange. Yeah. Why would that happen?
Oh, they understood radiation.
Okay,
it was their early days.
Well, I don't know. Did they really? I mean, like, I'm so. It's crazy. This is like just wow. Is this fun or what? I love this constant stream of segues.
Yeah.
So it drives me crazy.
Yeah, do you remember back before the Segway transformed transportation?
Oh no, the segue is going to become a shtick.
Don't you remember? I mean, all the news articles were out there about how, like, we would have to remake cities.
Yeah.
That within a matter of years, cities would be completely different. We'd have, like, priority segue lanes, walking.
Walking
would become a thing of the past. And today, as we don't walk down sidewalks.
I know.
I took my segue in.
Well, that's how I knew you were a Neo-Luddite, because you didn't come in a subway.
Yes, I left my segue. I have a coal-burning segue.
We're the only two uncool people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everyone else is way cooler. We live in a Segway future.
Us, everyone else and the mole cops. Yeah. It's an army of blarts out there saying, hey, man, don't diss my Segway.
Don't diss me. Yeah, I just remember. I may be the only person who remembers the hype around the Segway.
Right. No, I remember.
All you have to do is say, do you remember the days before the Segway changed our lives? Everyone's like, oh, yeah, I remember that.
It seems like every year the internet's around, I spend more time going, what?
Yeah.
You know? And you know, a lot of people are arguing that society is getting worse. So there's two ways you can look at this. One is that
there's an infinity of ways to look at something, I assure you.
I'm totally Hegelian you right now. So you know, you're right. If anybody tries to offer to you a binary choice, demand a third one. So well done, sir. But there's two ways I can bring up to look at this, which is one is that it's become this terrible feedback loop where people are just bringing out the worst in each other, and the internet is making the world a worse place, and that's why we're seeing so much craziness on it. And I agree. Don't worry. Mm-hmm. When you say it out loud, it sounds crazy, but I think a lot of people implicitly assume that, because a lot of people are like, it's so much worse than it used to be. And a lot of parents, for instance, don't let their kids go outside because they think the world is a worse place. But I don't really think it is. Here's the here's an opposing view, which is really what I think. Put that on the floor. Sorry about that. Anyway, so an opposing view, which is that it really was always this bad. And the thing that makes more sense to me is it was always this bad, and the internet gave us the ability to look at it and say, oh, okay, I never saw this before, but now it's in plain sight. Because it didn't fit in the soundbite on a news program before, and it didn't, you know, it was on page 53, so even if they wrote an article on it, nobody would read it, you know, and that's assuming anybody even picked it up. You know, again, the journalism skills aren't always the same as the tech skills, hence why we're in a technocracy, you know, so.
It's...
What do you think? Why is it that when people say, not even saying it is getting worse, but when people say it seems to be getting worse, are they right or are they wrong, and why?
They say worse, but I think what they really mean is confusing or out of control or chaotic.
Mm-hmm.
Previous generations, if you wanted to know a thing, you had to go out of your way to seek it out.
Mm-hmm.
There was a cultivated set of knowledge that was readily available, whether it be current events through the mechanism of journalism, whether it would be standard histories as presented in schools, whether it be it's even engineering approaches. Like, there's a set way of calculating, you know, different material design sorts of things.
Right.
what the internet has allowed you to do is at a very low cost present ideas that don't necessarily fit with that general narrative,
mm-hmm.
get them out there, and make them very easy to find.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not that these things were previously hiding or being hidden. There was just no economic value behind broadcasting them.
Right.
You know, it wasn't
right.
popular.
It didn't sell.
Exactly. You can't sell books with a crazy conspiracy theory. You know, you can't.
Keep going.
But, you know, ideas that were perhaps dismissed 100 years ago stayed dead. Now, because you have the tool to do the research very quickly, and because the cost of putting out a like crazy idea is so low,
mm-hmm.
that you're constantly being confronted.
You mean like the show?
Like the show.
Thank you.
You're constantly being confronted by things that would ordinarily never even appear in front of you.
Right.
So it weakens the core narrative.
Mm-hmm.
That people seem to need. We don't do well with chaos. We like order.
Why do people like order like that so much? What's
because the
there?
World is such a complex place. The world is such a chaotic place that if you have a story, a core thing upon which you can lean,
mm-hmm.
You can accept new information. We're just being bombarded at this point. And
right.
again, because we're not taught how to think and how to discern and how to approach the world in a methodical way to make progress, now you've got all these ideas and you don't know which one's right.
Right.
You don't know what's true. You don't, you know, previously you just trust certain sources, and these sources are being constantly exposed as being having their own agenda or trying to manipulate things or present a narrative because, oh, well, here's the other side of that story, which mm-hmm. you'd ordinarily never see.
Right.
But it's like, oh, wait, it's right there. Like, well, can I... And so I don't necessarily think worse. I think people find it the world much more confusing, much more chaotic, much more...
That's a great word. I like that word, confusing. Definitely people find it more confusing.
There's just more out there, and they lack the tools to really discern what isn't... A, what isn't is not important. B, what of the things that are important, what isn't is not true.
Mm-hmm.
See how to, you know, even communicate with other people about that. And so you wind up in the situation where also we can form communities that ordinarily wouldn't have come together.
Mm-hmm.
Which is super powerful.
Immediately into my mind, /. But, you know, it was pretty good in the early days.
I never read it. I'd been /ed 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
But I was never, like, actually on /.
Right, right. /ed was a website. It still is a website. It's still very popular, but...
Oh, God, it's 2019, and we're going to have to describe what /ed was.
Yeah, yeah. No, but, I mean, it's true. What if someone was born in 2000? In 2000, people were on /ed, and you got /ed'd, and your server melted.
Yep.
Basically, you got 20,000 hits in 20 minutes, and you're, you know, you and it
I
was the web 1.0 those days,
yeah.
And it was just
I never
one,
melted.
It was just one.
Yeah, I've been /ed a few times.
My hardware sucked. Down. I was killed. I was immediately murdered. Someone put up a copy. So it was my book actually.
Yeah, do it.
So
there used to be a thing called the C10K problem.
I don't even remember. I don't even remember.
10,000 concurrent web connections.
No, I never, you know
yeah,
what?
Yeah, servers.
I never kept a server alive long enough during a /ed.
It was.
Or it just got patched and I didn't even recognize it.
There were resource-related issues to how the predominant web servers at the time could not handle like 10,000 concurrent connections, and it was called the C10K problem.
Really? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to look that up. That's great.
There you go. Terrible internet history.
I do not claim to know everything.
No, that's fine.
You know, and... yeah, that's really interesting. I'm going to check that out.
Old school.
You know what?
Web
I just
engineering.
I patch maniacally with my systems. I keep them updated. I patch them. You know, and every system I've been in charge of, I patch. I didn't like if you go back far enough, it didn't at one point learned a lesson, and then immediately after that, no longer needed to learn the lesson anymore, and patched avidly. So I probably just patched it and didn't realize it was an issue.
It was a real thing.
Yeah. So, where were we? We were talking about. Oh, yeah. So you were talking about how they're just confused. So
I'm not saying people are confused. I say the world is a confusing place.
Right. Well, I'm not saying that their confusion wasn't inevitable.
Hmm.
Right. You know, I mean, so I can go, there's two ways I can go with this. I can tell you about...
There's an infinity of ways you can go with this.
You are so rebellious. I mean, I'm proud of you. That is great.
Listen, you know, when you arrive at a fork in the road, tear across the median.
Yes, yes. That's
what I do.
Right. You know, I think my next truck will be a Ford Raptor, because there's nothing like just pulling off the parkway and not even slowing down.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. I'm kind of like confused as what this. I can talk about the complexity horizon, which is an idea that I had about. I mean, it's not, the idea may not be new, but I think the name is, which is this idea that there's a point at which it's no longer possible, the rate of change in a particular topic is so fast, it's no longer possible to talk about the topic anymore. The only way you can communicate about it is in code, because the code is changing faster than human language can.
There's this science fiction novel I read 20 years ago. It's called Tomorrow and Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And I barely remember it. And in my recollection, it's good.
Right.
Which always makes me afraid, because I have a feeling if I reread it...
Like the Smurfs?
If I reread it, I'm going to realize it's terrible. But one of the points, this guy basically travels into the future through a variety of mechanisms, and he's like encountering different ages of humanity for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And he hits one age in which technical specialties they've become so specialized that they literally cannot communicate with one another.
Mm-hmm.
They just exist in this nexus of jargon. So, like, your insect biologists have developed effectively their own lexicon and their own language just to talk amongst themselves, because it's gotten so finely detailed that they invent all these new terms that nobody else even bothers to learn.
Right.
And so everybody kind of speaks common, but when you get two or three people at the same...
So it's a technocracy. On topic! Yes.
But when you get, like, two or three people who are associated with that specialty,
yes,
they kind of do this, like, hive mind thing where they have their own language. And you're kind of starting to see it. Like, we used slime and STEM and all the rest of this earlier today.
Right.
It's like, they're acronyms. If you don't know what STEM is, you think it's part of a plant. If you do, then you understand in technology. You know,
right.
Stuff. Within the military, they've got acronyms up in the proverbial wazoo,
right,
which I'm sure is an acronym for something. you know, in tech, we've got a lot of...
FUBAR's my favorite. Thank you for that. Thank you for FUBAR. Yeah.
In tech, we've got all these, like, terms that the layman has no idea what they are. And you can kind of see that evolve, potentially.
Right, right.
Like, this isolating groupthink sort of thing. And even in politics, I mean, there are terms for, law. You can throw out a phrase,
right,
like some major case, you know, like,
right,
Smith versus Jones.
Right, right.
And then, like, all the lawyers go,
Smith v. Jones.
Yeah, Smith v. Jones. And all the lawyers go, and you're sitting there like...
Their acronyms just all have V's in the middle.
No.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, they're doing it too. You're right.
So,
well, pretty soon it'll be the computers doing that for them.
Which is even...
They'll just be throwing this v. that, that v. this, this v. that.
Law, oh, God. Law. Technology.
Case law by bot farm.
Yeah, technology and law is one of those, like, weird things where we've got so much that can happen.
Right.
In terms of making our judicial system back to what it should be.
Right.
But none of those people have any idea how to program. None of them have any idea how to use the technology in order to make their lives easier and to improve the conditions for defendants and people who have to engage with the legal system.
Right.
So that's one of the frustrating things. I had a very long talk with somebody about that recently. It's
yeah. So I mean, it seems to me like I don't want to. Yeah, we can come back to that other thing later. We're gonna need so many more shows. We're gonna need more shows. Anyway, case law is it's interesting because there's so much. Most people don't. So, in a way, that's a perfect example of the legal technocracy, mm-hmm. right? You know, of course, lawyers are technocracy, and they warned us about it at the beginning of the... So technocracy itself isn't new, you know, this idea. I mean, you can easily find references to the word itself is its meaning as we're using it now 100 years ago. In particular, the one I found was that stockbrokers were using it to talk about financial instruments in the 20s, you know, and saying, nobody understands what we're doing, you know, which was probably true at the time.
So the quants of the 20s.
The quants of the 20s, which is kind of an interesting time to point at, but whatever. Hopefully there's not any precedent there.
I wasn't pointing at anything at all.
I'd love to come back to your analogy about how to screw a market. Not your analogy, your factual instructions, but maybe not the entire apocalypse in one episode.
Okay.
So
we've already got new codes. Why not?
Yeah, new codes. Why not go for market death? The case law is the technocratic language of lawyers, mm-hmm. and the problem is that it kind of becomes this unwieldy monster where only a handful of people represent it. So it almost becomes a good model for how to deal with the technocracy. Like if you're looking at the confusion created by the confusing state of things, mm-hmm. not to pick on anyone and say they're confused.
On is how people deal with it.
Right. Don't get me started.
I've got a great story for that.
Okay, go.
So I was asked by the New York County Lawyers Association several years ago, probably late 90s, and it was a forum on cryptography and privacy. Mm-hmm. And it was a panel of six people.
Right.
They had a detective from the NYPD. Mm-hmm. They had a somebody from the Manhattan DA's office specializing in electronic crimes. Mm-hmm. They had an agent from the FBI, the electronic crimes division at New York field office, and a federal prosecutor, and some guy from the ACLU, and me. And we're all talking before this thing.
So you guys are like the motley crew.
Right, and we're all just kind of chatting beforehand, and you know, I'm talking with the cops and the FBI guy and the ACLU guy, and we finally shuffle in, and they do the introductions, and do, and then there's Isaac the hacker, and the four of them all turn. And so,
this is awkward.
Yeah, it's, hello. Did I say anything? So we each had like 5 minutes to kind of talk. And I couldn't resist. I had to open with a lawyer joke. I'm basically in front of the New York County Bar Association, and it was like,
tell it to laugh.
Yeah. What do you call a lawyer buried up to his neck in sand? Time to order more sand. Thank you very much. And it got that level of groan. And I said, all right, bear with me. There was a purpose.
Did you hear the safeties go off?
Yeah. Bear with me. You know, I have a point behind this.
No, it's like, fine. Go for it.
Well, that's what I told them, and I'm telling you.
Nice.
They said, who here owns an automobile? All right, you go to your mechanic. He tells you that the flux capacitor is broken, and you're going to need to repair it. How many just implicitly trust your mechanic? You just sign the check, and you're on your way. Like, nobody raises their hand. They say, hey, anybody here ever been sick? Have you been sick? Okay, you go to your doctor. He tells you you need to have your leg amputated. Do you just immediately, trust your doctor, or do you go seek a second opinion? All right. Anybody here have a computer? Oh no. Actually, I jumped ahead of myself. You know, I was like, who here have ever had their client, you lawyers, ask to explain something or not trust your immediate decision on like how you should approach something? It's like all of our clients, they just completely disbelieve us. Right? And how many of you have a computer, you know, and it breaks? Like, how many of you trust the guy who comes to fix your computer or a computer hacker? It's like the common person has these jokes, lawyer jokes, and all the rest of it, because these are horribly complex systems. Mm-hmm. That if you don't understand how to even begin to approach them, they're like magic. Mm-hmm. You know, an automobile, like lots of stuff going on. If you're not a mechanic, like you are powerless, and you are in the you know, you have to deal with the mechanic. You know,
right.
Doctor. If you could fix your own body, you wouldn't be going to the doctor. The law is constantly evolving. Like, at least a human body, you know where the heart goes and like where the kidneys are and all the rest of that. You know, it's very complex, very organic, and all the rest of that in the chemistry sense of organic.
Mm-hmm.
you know, the doctor knows things that you don't, and you have to trust them. You're powerless. The lawyer, the law, huge, very complex. You have to trust the lawyer. Powerless.
Mm-hmm.
Your computer, you don't know how it works. You have to trust the hacker. You're powerless. And so that lack of trust, that lack of agency over your own destiny in dealing with these complex systems causes things like lawyer jokes,
right?
Like the mechanic joke.
That's
like,
awesome. The joke, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You know,
it hasn't happened yet, but give it a few more years.
Yeah, yeah.
It will be there.
Those crazy hackers and all the rest of it. And I thought it did really well because I actually had a room full of lawyers go, like
that was delivered.
Yeah. So. It was just a little offhand comment you had. It's like, yeah, mockery or some. It's just, that's how people deal with it.
Right.
Their lack of agency, their lack of power, and the lack of understanding. And so when you have a group of people who are able to converse at that level and you're an outsider and you're looking in,
mm-hmm.
Jargon is off-putting. Jargon is frightening.
So I think the evidence is demonstrable that civilization is completely irrational. And this is actually it's terrifying to think about it, but I think it's true. Because we have to depend on people all the time. And the bigger society gets and the bigger civilization gets, the more you have to trust other people.
Civilization is work.
Like, it's a ton of work.
It part of it's organic, but it's also you have to have people who want to be a part of it,
mm-hmm.
who pull their weight, as it were.
Right.
Who recognize, like, yes, I have this set of rights.
Mm-hmm.
And these resources,
mm-hmm.
and I benefit by engaging in a society in such a way that perhaps I restrain my rights a little bit, perhaps mm-hmm. I use these resources in a way that other people can sort of augment, and we work together in order to build a thing.
Right.
And there are ways to do to organize a civilization successfully.
Right.
And there are ways to organize a civilization unsuccessfully.
But why? Why do it?
Why do it at all?
Yeah. Why organize? Why not just move to the sticks and, you know, someplace where there's no nuclear power plants and
sure.
hide out?
And you can
get off my property.
Yeah. And you can totally do that.
I say that with absolute love.
Lots of love. And there are nations in the world where that is just how it works.
Right.
There are ages in which that's just how it works. But there's a benefit to specializing in an economy. You know, you are good at building chairs. This guy is good at growing chickens.
Right.
And also eggs.
Right.
And this guy is good at, processing water, and that one's good at building engines, you know.
Right.
When you're able to specialize and engage in a market economy where people's talents and their strengths are able to produce more than each individual,
right.
You benefit.
Right, though they have to invest in that position.
Yeah.
And then, of course, whenever you invest in something, whether it's investing the time to become that doctor, mm-hmm. become that lawyer, become that technician, become that engineer, you know, and you're taking a risk because it could come. People can come and take it away from you. The barbarians can come and storm into the gates.
Sure.
You know, and that,
or you realize the thing that you've invested in is not actually worthwhile, or is not worth anything on the market.
So I want to open people's minds to the possibility. I'm not saying it's true, but you're welcome to tell me I'm wrong, that maybe it isn't actually logical, that the logical conclusion is we're doomed, and that the reason that we keep that we keep not being doomed is because everybody keeps doing the irrational thing and just looking out for each other. In a way that think about it as humans as lovable, cute creatures that do the right thing even when it doesn't make sense for themselves.
Sure. I like that.
Okay.
I'm one of those rare people who think that deep down people are innately good.
Right.
And
I agree, by the way.
And the expression of this goodness is often in being selfish.
Right.
And recognizing that, you know, me wanting things is not necessarily bad.
Am I going to ruin your reputation by making you say that?
No.
Because you're not going to be able to do a maniacal laugh and walk into the room from the shadows.
Oh, I can do that.
Maybe with entrance. Please don't!
Yeah, no, I can do the maniacal laugh. I mean,
we should all do it together.
the Buddhist is of the opinion that, you know, desire is the root of all suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But I would modify. Far be it from me to correct the Buddha.
With a thousand exceptions, by the way. Yeah.
I think irrational desire is the root of all suffering.
Yes.
To want a thing for a reason is not a problem, really.
Right.
You know, if it's obtainable, if you can engage in an exchange with somebody in order to achieve it. Because, when you trade, both parties are better.
Right.
Right. When you do that, when you do those trades and when you come together and you make the environment in which that can happen, you are building cities.
You just described reason, by the way, I think. Reason itself.
Well,
right?
This dives into deep economy,
right.
You know, the rational actor, the rational person who's engaging in an economy. But you don't have to be rational,
right?
Like, you can assign value to things.
Clearly not.
Yeah, you can assign value to things and have a perfectly operational market economy based on rational desires, meaning I need food, I need water, I need all the rest of it.
If there's a market,
but I also need sneakers.
If there's a market and you're not rational, smack.
Well, yeah.
Smack.
Yeah.
Smack. Okay. All right. I'll be rational.
The unseen hand,
right,
you know,
right.
will come and figure it out.
I spent too much on this. Smack.
Yeah. and, you know, you need to have that happen.
Yeah.
So there's you can be irrational and entirely. I mean, who needs shiny rocks?
Right.
And yet we have a diamond market, which is entirely manipulated, and that's a whole other subject.
Right.
But, like, you know, it's. It's interesting.
Who needs currency at all, right? And currency itself is...
Currency itself solves a problem. It is a more efficient way of handling trade than barter.
Right.
Like, it emerges out of having a market.
Right.
I
have to say, you really are doing great at following me down the rabbit hole. You know, like, this is not specifically...
I like your red and blue pill there.
Thanks. I thought I know.
Does your wife know you took her earring box for that?
Sooner or later, someone's going to come in here and eat one of them.
Oh.
And it's going to be funny, because who knows what's really in there.
Ooh.
Yeah, you know, don't spoil it.
Bullion and I don't know. Where are we in time?
Well, isn't that the point of the red pill? You don't actually know.
Yeah, what's going to happen on the other end of it?
So I don't know if you want to discuss your market pollution theory.
So
the idea that the more generic concept is a poison well.
Okay.
Right. So poisoning the well of the markets, and so, you know, enough do good stuff. Let's talk a little bit about the darkness. So, you know, how would you manipulate a market? How would you control it? You know, and I'm not necessarily just talking about. I'm glad that you're on board with me that currency isn't necessarily shiny metal, right? It can be other things.
Yeah, it's an emergent property of them.
It can be code.
It can be anything.
It could be digidollars. It could be.
Oh, you want to go down the Bitcoin realm?
It could be encrypted crypto dollars.
Sure.
Right. It could be anything. It could be likes on YouTube, right?
That is a frightening thought, but sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there was that. That's why I wanted to bring up see Black Mirror. I'm going to start spoiling it soon, so you got a few episodes, and then it's coming out. So watch all of them. Anyway,
I've seen two.
They're really dark. So, I think the right recipe, if you don't want to be polluted with depression and sadness, is flip back and forth before the Orville and Black Mirror, right?
Because the Orville.
The Orville is like Star Trek, but with curses. Sarcasm.
Star Trek has gone super dark and just sad.
Right. I stopped paying attention after Next Generation. Sorry.
You know, great for Mr. McFarlane to, he got Next Generation. He understood what was there, telling a story, using the series as a vehicle, but also having fun.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that aspect of it is really nice, where it's lighter in a way that just makes the characters feel more real. Mm-hmm. As opposed to like the perfect military robots that are, you know, commander. I mean, hell, Next Generation even had a robot as an officer.
Right. They had literally.
But yeah, you know, like they turn into caricatures. Regardless, I'm sorry.
I do not understand, Captain. Yeah. No matter how many times I watch Water Boiling, it always takes the same amount of time.
Same amount of time. It's like, all right, thanks. Anyway, Black Mirror and back to currency. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So I'm just curious if you had any like. You know, it occurs to me that your case, so you made this case, this is an icon, one of the icon panels, and it was...
A long time ago.
Yeah. That all you have to do to subvert a market is just start introducing corruption into it, here and there, over time, and let it accumulate.
The trust issue for the stock market.
Right. So it seems to me this is a special case of a poison well. So what do you think about poison wells in general, not just in markets, but also in code?
Wells poisoned.
Yeah. Well, you know? Yeah,
I like
me either.
Drink my water. Yeah, well, that was the story where I was.
What's your poison?
Yeah, pick your poison.
We're good.
Okay. So that particular event was I was talking to a conference where they occasionally will like wind up with a speaker who had to cancel at the last moment, and they'll be like, Isaac, talk to us for 20 minutes.
Right.
And I get on.
That is a very rare skill.
Yeah.
Being able to get up in front of a crowd and go.
Yeah. I come up to the podium and I'm like, does anybody have a question that they'd actually want answered, or should I talk about a thing? And it's like, what keeps you up at night? And this was a financial market group. And I said,
does it still keep you up at night?
This thing I'm about to describe?
Yeah.
Well, they fixed the particular thing that I was discussing. But,
okay.
Generally speaking. So markets are very stock markets.
Right.
Not like the not a capitalist economy market, you know, the very generalist thing of you walk into Walmart, I exchange money for goods and services and sort of market, but like the stock market.
Right.
The New York Stock Exchange in particular.
Mm-hmm.
You have a small population of people who behave semi-rationally, if not completely irrationally. Well, nice. I mean, you laugh, but like you, I would strongly recommend the book "A Random Walk Down Wall Street" to really kind of get an idea of how things work inside.
Well, we have the advantage because we live in New York, so we see this stuff up
literally
close.
On
we
the street,
work for these companies. We work side by side with people who have worked there or do work there, so we
just
know.
Turn on Bloomberg TV for about 5 or 10 minutes, and you want jargon. You want like a subculture that has its own language. But I said, all right, well, let me throw you out a scenario. I get into a major trading firm through evil hacker means.
Excellent.
And I today buy 3M in such a way that I drive the price up 10 points.
Mm-hmm.
It was a legitimate trade that one of this brokerage firm's customers made, but I manipulated it in such a way that by the time it hit the market, the number that the customer had associated with their account is different than what actually hit the order, the execution, and I covered it up internal to the brokerage system so that it like tucked into a happy little other account. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I do the same thing tomorrow, except it's 10 points in the other direction. 2 days later, I move it, maybe 75 points. I just diddle with the numbers a little bit. Like Superman 3, the half penny thing to add up the thing.
Right.
But I'm not doing half
space.
I'm not doing the half pennies. I'm just manipulating the data.
Right.
6 weeks later, I splash 10%, 1,000 points.
Now, why do you do that part?
I do that part in order to get noticed.
Ah, credibility.
Well, not necessarily credibility. It's
notoriety.
Well, somebody hacked into this system. And what that spawns is an audit.
Mm-hmm.
And what that audit will discover is that for the past 6 weeks, the price of 3M has been manipulated by a non-market actor using evil hacker means.
Mm-hmm. This is hypothetical.
Yeah, it's just totally hypothetical.
3M, please don't sue us.
Yeah.
Or New York Stock Exchange.
I just like their symbol, MMM. I chose them, Widget Co.
Right, yeah, no, that's fine.
Right? But I mean, even take the evil hacker thing.
It's a difference between a forecast and a call to action.
Sure.
I find myself saying that a lot lately online.
Well,
you know, this is a forecast. I'm not telling people to do this. Is what
no,
I think will happen.
I mean, this isn't a thing
This is a forecast of a risk. This is a risk analysis.
Yeah. The internal mechanisms prevent this sort of thing much more readily today than they did at the time I was discussing this.
Right.
Where you could like manipulate data on the wire. The wire is figured out, but it doesn't really matter the details. The point is that you create a trail surreptitiously, and then you make a very obvious thing happen, mm-hmm. which causes the investigation that goes back and recognizes, oh, wow, this data has been completely manipulated over the past 6 weeks. What mm-hmm. happens then? Anybody who has dealt with that stock, you probably just accept the price minus the, my 1,000-point obvious, you know, like, ta-da!
Right.
Do you just accept that price? Or do you try to unwind all of the manipulation all the way back for the past 6 weeks? What basically happens is lawsuits launch like ICBMs at the end of war games.
It's the doomsday machine.
Yeah.
Yeehaw!
Where, you know, like, clients start suing the brokerage house, the different brokerage houses sue each other, you know, like, all the rest of the guys. The reality is what's going to happen is they're just going to declare this is the price today, and anything that happened in the past was all screwed up, and you know what, the market had a price, and that's what we're going to go with.
Mm. But what does that declaration do?
What happens is the confidence in the market is no longer inviolate, right? The stock price is no longer necessarily a thing that clears on the market.
Mm-hmm.
The client has become separated from the price mm-hmm. at the exchange. And so the confidence drops, and that becomes a problem. Is it a long-term problem? I don't personally think so. I think that gets fixed. I think that it is able to be rebuilt. But what it does do is say these computers may not necessarily be doing the right thing.
Right.
You know, you had flash crashes, and they still happen occasionally, particularly as we go into the quant era, where you have automated trading, where your actual broker or your trader is sitting there, and they're just kind of driving these computers, mm-hmm. and the computers are what's really making the decisions,
right.
using AI and all the rest of these sorts of algorithms.
These days, yes.
Not in the past.
But.
And that's a thing that can still happen. But the scenario I was throwing out at this conference at that time, like, people in the audience were like, oh, that would be a really bad day.
So
let
me introduce a new bad day.
Uh-huh.
Aside from what you said,
yeah.
which is that the algorithms themselves could do the same thing.
Sure.
They could lose confidence in each other.
Sure.
Or themselves and say, I no longer know what's going on. And if that happens, there may be a contingency plan.
I need to bail out of my position. And now everybody
right.
sells and you wind up with...
And of course, that's what people think happens with flash crashes. Is the algos all...
Yep.
All feed off
they
each
all
other.
Try to
Everyone's
off.
Like, oh, it's a conspiracy. Some company's selling and they have a backroom deal.
But
the algos just panic.
Yeah,
and go into a safe mode.
Yeah, he bails. They try to bail out. They close the position as quickly as they can. And but what's fascinating is it's been theorized, and you know, I have no idea because I'm not on the exchanges at all, and I'm not writing software for this. But if you know that this is a thing can happen, you can write an algorithm that looks for the flash crash
mm-hmm.
and buys the discounted inventory.
Right. I mean, it's a legitimate trade. You just have to trick your enemy, your opponent,
absolutely.
Into making a bad move.
But that winds up being that's a dynamic exchange at that point. And
right.
so it's fine again. Like, the system can survive this stuff, and it always does.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like,
you got to be careful. People are going to think you're a capitalist.
I am.
I know, I am too.
Okay. But not, I mean, capitalism.
It's a dirty word these days.
Yeah, it's a dirty word, but it's because people
all this talk about how markets have meaningful information, you know.
But it's this, there is, at the root of all this politics and all this economics and all the rest of it, is two notions of approaching the world. The first is that we don't have any idea how anything works.
Mm.
And that the world, economics, humans, civilization, whole nine yards, is just emergent from the chaos.
Mm-hmm.
That if you get enough stuff and you just kind of let it do what it's supposed to do, order will arise.
Mm-hmm.
and solutions will be found because that's how it works. The other side is we know everything. If we only had all the information, we could engineer all of this to make it much more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And by exerting control and design and architecture, ironically, the people who tend to believe this are the ones who don't structure and don't design their software and don't do all the rest of the things that we were talking about very early in the project.
So in other words, they're running with their hands waving in the air going, whee!
Yeah. Yeah, it's science and math and engineering can solve all of this, and that we humans are able to organize everything and create the world in which we want to live.
Yeah,
and I think that is the primary conflict in the world. You've got your capitalists and your communists. You've got your conservatives and your progressives. You've got command and emergence.
Right.
And
so you're a Babylon 5 fan.
I've never seen Babylon 5.
Oh, okay. No, I'll spoil it.
Yeah.
There's a good and evil component later in the series. Anyway, keep... Babylon 5 fans are going, yes, I know what he's talking about right now.
Good and evil is a whole other ballgame.
Right. Well, actually, let me be more specific. Evil is portrayed as... chaos is portrayed as evil, and order is portrayed as good. But, of course, that's not the case at all, is it?
Well, I'm describing two kinds of order is the point.
Right. Well, everything's order. Even chaos takes planning. You can't have true chaos without a lot of planning.
I mean, the notion that capitalism and the sort of emergent order isn't real order is false.
Right. Agreed.
You know, life is emergent order out of the chaos of the primordial
sea. Right.
It did not require...
Cities are part of nature.
...thinking meat in order to make it happen. Yeah.
Thinking meat.
You know, that... Let kind of nature do what it's supposed to do.
Right.
Within economics itself. You know, this is the Austrian school versus the Keynesians. You know, the Austrian school is, we don't know nothing. we don't know how this works. We can't know how this works. What we can do is we can observe stuff, primarily at the micro level, and then based on what we sort of observe at the micro level, we can kind of see what happens at the macro level. The Keynesian is, well, you know, we can simplify all of this. You know, aggregate demand, aggregate supply, and then we can, tweak a couple of little knobs, and that's an economy. I kind of drift to the ignorance.
Right.
I embrace ignorance.
Right.
I recognize that I've got some tools that I can use in order to maybe predict some things, that maybe I can start engineering against the odds and bring a tiny little bit of order into the world and hope that in bringing a little bit of order to the world in combination with some other bits of order that more order emerges from that, as opposed to, well, if I had all the information available to me, we could perfectly simulate this and become far more efficient. It's no, nature figured it out. Let nature do its thing.
Right.
You know, just let it happen.
Right.
It's ugly. It's gross.
So what do you think when someone comes in there and they go, try to push it a little bit? How much pushing is okay?
It depends on how the pushing happens. If you're a participant pushing, good for you.
Right.
If you are trying to impose a will of by usurping somebody else's resources in order to do that, then you've got a problem.
Right.
It's the difference between the regulator coming in and saying, I am going to use the power that is vested in me by the population in this government in order to make you act a certain way, or, hey, I'm just here like everybody else, and I've got $1 million just like you do, and I'm going to try to get you to do what you want to do.
Right.
If you coming to the table with your resources and applying only those, good for you. If you're trying to steal somebody else's resources and then exert your will over them, that's where it starts to fall apart for me.
Right. So, the counter argument would be, what is steal? Right. Yeah. when is it really stealing?
Steals pretty easy to figure out.
Yeah. Well, the easy case of steal is easy to figure out. The hard case isn't.
What's the hard case of stealing?
The hard case of stealing is it's a service fee.
Ooh.
Right?
Yeah.
You know?
Am I getting something for the service fee?
Yeah, but maybe not enough.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Do I have a choice to not participate in this at all?
No, that depends.
Well, if I don't, then that's called stealing.
Right. So where is the choice, right? When the cost of, you can not participate, but the cost of the next product up is twice as high, but if you scale twice as big, it equals out.
Well, then you come in, this is...
So it becomes a tyranny of scale is what I'm getting at.
Well, this is knocking on the door of public good. What is a public good?
Right.
It... I've had a little too much wine. But it's...
Your kindness is showing. Look out.
Non-rival and non-exclusive.
I got to get the heart in the cooler.
Yeah. non-rival and non-exclusive. So, like, defense
right.
as a concept, which, again, as a, like, I hate goofy concepts like defense.
Yeah.
But, you know, defense. Okay, well, we all got to pay into it. Mm-hmm. Why? Because, well, if you pay $100...
Pirates.
Yeah, if you pay $100 and you pay $50, he doesn't get twice as much defense as you do.
Right.
If you don't pay anything and you pay $50, you don't get any less defense because you just happen to be where you are.
Right.
Like, the Department of Defense is not going to show up as like, okay, well, you can attack New York. You can't attack New York except for Matt's house. We don't defend him. He didn't pay this week.
I sound like a rich man with a tropical island.
Yeah, he didn't pay this week, so like
I didn't get protector status.
Yeah, so like if you want to really finally target your weapon at his house, we're not going to do anything. Like
right.
No, a public good is non-rival and non-exclusive.
Right.
And so kind of laying out, all right, well, here's your contribution to that. Like we can't take you out of it, and you're not going to get any more for. Paying more or less, then it's a public good. And there is efficiency in provision of public goods. And that's where governments come in.
Right.
Governments are really good at delivering public goods. They're terrible at delivering everything else.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if there's a thing that you can use, either to the exclusion of somebody else or to rival with somebody else's use of the thing, that's not a public good and shouldn't be provided by the government.
All right.
This is carry my libertarian capitalist flag around. Just like
that's great, man.
Yeah.
No, I agree.
I mean, the basics of the.
I tend to default to libertarianism until a better argument is presented. In the same way that I think the republic is, you know, the capitalist republic is the best system we have, even though it's really flawed. You know, it's just a little bit better than all the others. But then again, are we even living under one? You know, and this can brings me to. A last question. We have
democratic tyranny.
By the way, did you know that we've almost blown through time?
I have no idea what time is it.
So you must be having fun because you haven't complained. You haven't given me the
I don't.
We have a secret nod, and you didn't give me the secret nod. So I'll try to wrap it up
We're coming up on the 3 hour mark. We should probably sort of sew it up.
You know, we hit two, I don't want to murder our viewers.
Yeah.
And if you like this, just clamor. Go online and clamor and say, we want more, and then I'll trick
We're
him,
I'll
con him, I mean, ask him to come back on, and we'll do more,
yeah.
Right? You know?
I could do an entire economics one, I could do a tech one, like, it's fun.
I mean, I'm
like that.
I'm not even close to spent.
Now, everybody read Human Action before
Human
the
Action.
Economics podcast.
Human
Or Action. Man, Economy, and State, as you like.
So, we didn't get to talk about... golden opportunities or anything like that, but actually I want to get around to technocracy and then we'll let people off the hook.
Sure. That's the old radio show I was on, Off the Hook.
Off the Hook? Really?
That was one of those.
Oh, yeah. How did you get in? Do you mind if we do one more thing and then we'll
Sure.
Off the Hook. How did you get into that?
I'm really
curious.
Yeah. So 2600 Magazine is the Hacker Quarterly. It's been around since, I think, the 80s, or mm-hmm. early 84. 84, I think, was the first issue. Manuel Goldstein is the publisher. And they were having a conference. The original HOPE, Hackers on Planet Earth conference, was in 94.
Mm-hmm.
I was attendee at that. And then there was...
I've been to a few.
Yeah. There's a successor conference called Beyond.
They're fun. Shut your phone off.
Yeah. Any hacker conference.
If you're wise, you'll shut your phone off.
Every hacker conference, like, leave your stuff at home. You know, bring the minimum.
And don't have a tight appointment in the elevator in case they toy with that.
Yeah. Elevators are a great, fun topic. don't play with elevators. Elevators will do everything in their power to keep you alive as long as you're inside them.
Right.
And you don't screw with them. So don't screw with elevators. But they're fascinating pieces of technology, the history of the lives. Regardless, HOPE. So I helped organize Beyond HOPE, which was in 97. And the radio show Off the Hook was there, and so I kind of showed up as just a person who was delivering, like, hey, here's what's happening at Beyond HOPE, the whole nine yards. And apparently I was liked by the audience and so forth, so I got to come back fairly regularly.
Okay.
And I was there pretty much every week for about four and a half years.
Wow. I can't believe I didn't know that. I don't know how I missed this about you.
Yeah. Following 9/11, I kind of left the show.
Really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, so the station it was on had a whole bunch of stuff going on, and I reprioritized quite a bit of my life, so.
Right.
Yeah, I miss it. I'm
yeah, you know, it's funny because, like, you know, the whole country, the whole world reprioritized after that.
Yeah.
But especially people in New York.
Yeah.
You could not possibly not shift after that. So,
yeah,
I mean, even if your philosophies didn't, your day-to-day took on new meaning.
Yeah, you became very aware of what was going on around you.
Right.
You know.
I mean, I've called out bags I see sitting alone on subways and in buildings. You know, I have a little bit of a rebellious, chaotic streak, but you know, this when a bag is sitting there and it doesn't belong to anyone.
Yeah, like what's going on?
Yeah, you know, kind of, yeah, I can't see what's in it. Okay,
yeah,
better tell someone.
Let's do the thing.
Let's do the thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I was very busy after 9/11, or during and then after 9/11, and I just kind of reprioritized. But
okay.
Yeah, I miss radio. This is fun. Like, this is the first, like, long format I've sat down in for a while. I've done a lot of little interviews for people.
Right.
Yards, but
it's great.
Yeah,
and you just
get to chat about random crap.
You're not afraid to go anywhere, which is really, really awesome. And you have...
I don't like narrow
places. Your brain to just crazy segues.
You remember
he did
the
it
days
again.
Before the Segway changed everything?
Oh man!
All transportation
volume is spike.
Segway based.
So
buses, a thing of the past. Do you remember buses?
Yeah, yeah. You know,
now that we have trains of Segways,
something like this actually happened. So something like this is we went cross country this year. My family and I went on a road trip and went cross country.
You rode Segways?
And we went, not Segways, electric scooters.
Oh, cool.
In Utah, Salt Lake City.
Oh, it's fun.
There is a large number of people using electric scooters as primary transportation, like, you know, like standing scooters.
Mm-hmm.
It's bizarre. It's weird.
Oh, the
it's like a sci-fi world. Like, you landed
those. If they were like a moped sort of electric.
I don't care if I like them or not. It was bizarre. Just seeing like half of the foot traffic was people going around on
electric scooters. You see them in the city too. It's like a thing.
Not
I gotta get my motorcycle back. That was a fun time.
What kind of bike did you ride?
Yamaha.
What do you want to ride?
My dream bike?
Yeah.
Or the right mid-range Honda ACE, Honda Shadow.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Like a nice...
So you're a cruiser guy now.
Like a
you,
nice
you don't want to go to 200 miles an hour.
No.
You don't want to find the limiter.
I've never been that guy.
Yeah, yeah. I've been that guy in a car, but a bike is crazy.
Yeah.
I'm afraid.
I want to put my foot down and, like... worry about not being able to pick back up.
Yeah, there's enough danger out there without adding to it. But, you know, crazy respect to the people who can.
I'm the tailing end of new math education. Like, I got bones that are getting fragile.
Yeah, yeah. You know what it is? It's when you do the physics math and you go, oh, this is the point where you must die.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. All right.
Yeah,
maybe 70 is the limit.
Aircraft
75,
is,
you know, if you're in a rush.
Aircraft is another one of those things. Like, I am... Just between you, me, and them.
Yeah.
Like, I am a nervous flyer.
Oh, dude, the camera's on.
No, I'm good. Yeah. Oh, sure. I'm not good in the back of the plane.
Oh, really?
If I'm in the front of the plane, I am happy.
Really?
Like, it is a great experience. But if I'm, like, in a normal seat and I'm looking out the window, I know too much.
Yeah.
Like,
oh man, you're thinking about it.
Those flaps didn't come.
Well, like, you know what? This is the problem with being the technocrat.
Like, yeah, there's why do we just change altitude? Like, is
you just see the
we
whole
haven't hit the
system in your mind.
Well, it's but not having all the inputs, right?
Right.
Like, oh, we didn't hit that VOR. Why are we off course?
Like, well, so it's almost like you see it like you see a schematic and then you see a formula and the problem is all the variables are blank.
But the worst part is, like, I know it's fine. I really dislike turbulence.
Right.
But I know the engineering behind the airplane is fine. You know, I've explained, do you want the secret to not being nervous on an airplane? It's evil.
Drugs?
No. Well, I'm sure. I don't go that route. But if you are frightened and you want to not be frightened,
okay.
You have to be an evil person.
Go on.
You make somebody else more scared than you are.
Oh.
At which point, they're now looking to you for comfort, and you got to man up.
You don't know something until you teach it.
Right.
Very clever. I like that.
And it's terrible. It's a terrible, terrible thing to do with another human being.
It's beautiful because you just put them in the engineering mindset.
Well, sure. But it's a poor,
I mean, really,
engineering mindset.
You know, necessity is the mother of invention.
There are a very few situations in which turbulence can take down an aircraft.
Yeah.
And yet, when we hit turbulence, I get very upset.
Right.
Like, well, what if a wing snaps off? And you explained, well, a wing really can't snap off. You see, there's a single connective brace that goes from wingtip to wingtip through the fuselage. It's not like they're bolted onto the sides. The
right.
wing is primarily the aircraft.
Right.
It's the rest of the plane that is kind of bolted onto it. So the
right.
wings aren't going to go like snap. I mean, they can eventually.
The rest of the plane will go snap.
Yeah.
Hence why you don't want to be in the back.
Right.
Excellent. Well explained.
The aerodynamics of the aircraft are severely compromised when the rest of the fuselage goes away as well. But it's not like you're
right.
just going to have the right wing fall off and the left wing is still there. Like, you would lose the rest of the aircraft.
Well, that's why you don't have any maker blogs right. on airplanes.
But, so I'm an engineer.
Nobody wants to do that.
So the point is, I think like an engineer. I know the math. I know the numbers. I don't get any comfort with that. Besides being evil, which I've gotten away from,
yes.
there is a thing that gives me comfort.
Right.
And it is the most irrational, crazy thing. An airplane is a sky whale.
Continue.
Okay.
And we're in its belly.
Yes.
It's very biblical.
The airplane is a sky whale. Think about a whale in the ocean.
Or Pinocchio, depending on
sure.
your preference.
A whale in the ocean is this huge, lumbering, massive thing.
Wow.
Have you ever seen a beached whale?
Yep.
They are miserable.
I mean, not in person.
Yeah.
That would be
I hope you never do.
It would be a little morose to be
yeah.
running.
I hope you never do. Because yeah. a beached whale is one of the saddest, like, just kind of, it's in its wrong environment.
Right.
And if you've ever seen a fully fueled 737 or 747 on the tarmac, its wings are kind of drooping because it's so full of fuel, and it just kind of like shuffles around.
And you can just look at the landing gear linkage.
Yeah, it's all
you can
like,
see how like, okay, one tiny fraction of the lateral force
yeah,
of the weight of that plane, those things are going to snap.
It's fragile, it's sad, it doesn't want to be there. The natural place for an aircraft
yeah.
is in the air, just as the natural place for a whale is in the ocean.
Dude, next time I'm on GCP driving past the airport, I'm going to be like, I'm going to crash.
Look at those lumbering.
I'm going to look at the lumbering, I'm going to look at one of the planes taking off and I'll be like, be free!
It's where it wants to be. Right. And so,
I'm happy for you!
And so the thing that actually gives me comfort, when, like, if I can get it in my head, because sometimes I'm just like a little freaked out, but if I can get it in my head, it's that the airplane, this is where it belongs. If the wings are kind of moving around a little bit and it's bumping, it's just
right.
riding the stream. It's a sky whale. It's
right.
happiest when it's aloft. And it wants to stay aloft. It does not want to be on the ground. It wants to stay in the air. And it will do what it can to be in the air.
Wow.
The engineering part of me, like, understands the physics, and it's like, everything is going to be fine. All the math says it's going to be fine. The thing that gives me comfort, sky whale.
Sky whale.
Like,
that's
it's
great.
It's weird. I think it's human.
No, that's
proof
good.
That I'm human, I think.
You,
like, some
totally
people
serious?
It.
I mean, all right, it's funny, but totally serious, you probably just helped someone. So,
yeah.
Great.
Sky whale.
I want to say thank you so much for coming on my first show.
Oh, that's how we're going to leave.
What you don't want to do?
It's poetic. It's poetic.
It's
I like
is
it.
Is this something? Well, all right. Let me say. Ask
no,
you this.
I like it.
I want to give you a chance. Do you want to end with Sky Whale?
I want to end with Sky Whale. I like Sky Whale.
I like Sky Whale too. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, sir.
All right.
It's been a pleasure.
All right. Good night. See you next Thursday.